Good to see you all. Rabbi Glenn and Alexander are still in Israel. And I did announce on Saturday that Jerry was going to be teaching the Bible study tonight. But he is giving the message on Shabbat. And he also told me that he's scheduled to do the parasha, the Torah portion. And so if he did the Bible study as well, that'd be a little too much. So here I am this evening. Let's turn to 1 Samuel chapter 20. We'll continue with this great book. All right, what is the main focus of the Bible? What's the main theme, main focus? Jesus. Yeshua. Salvation, the coming of the seed of the woman, the Redeemer, who is going to undo all the damage done in the Garden of Eden. And that's what the Word of God focuses us on, starting from the first chapters of Genesis. And then he, you know, comes through Seth, and then through Noah, and then through Shem, and then through Abraham, then Isaac, then Jacob, then Judah, and then finally, one of the tribes, families within Judah, God is going to make a covenant with King David. So David is absolutely pivotal in the focus of the Word of God, because through David and his royal dynasty will come the ultimate King of Kings, who will rule over Israel and the nations and undo all the damage done in Eden and reconcile man to God and bring in everlasting righteousness. The first king of Israel turned out to be a huge disappointment, Saul. He was taller than everyone. He was handsome. He outwardly looked like he would be a great king, but he was a huge disappointment. He made some foolish decisions. He was disobedient, and the Lord regretted making Saul king and decided to take the kingdom away from Saul and give it to this young man, David. Saul's been king. He is a strong ruler. David has been introduced to us. And so Saul is on this downward spiral. David is on an upward spiral. Many kings are constantly looking out for those who would rebel against them. And so Saul is suspicious of David. He views David as a threat. He's already tried to kill David by throwing a spear at him. David flees, and he goes to another powerful figure in Israel's kingdom, and that is the prophet Samuel. Old wise Samuel, who was a prophet. When Saul is trying to have David killed, David escapes and goes to Samuel. Saul finds out that David has gone to Samuel. He sends a group of messengers, but when you think messengers, they're more like trained warriors, assassins, killers on the way up to Samuel. Someone even stronger and more powerful, the Spirit of God falls on the first group of, you know, warriors, overpowers them. They come under the influence of the Spirit of God. They start prophesying. They don't pursue their mission. They go back and report to Saul that they failed. Saul is not dissuaded. He sends another group. Same thing happens. The Spirit of God falls on the second group, and they prophesy, and instead of pursuing David, they come back and report to Saul another mission failure. Happens to a third group. The Spirit of God falls on them. They prophesy. God is speaking to them. They do not pursue David. They return. David's still with Samuel. Saul comes to the conclusion, not that he should leave David alone, but, you know, if you're going to do something right, do it yourself. I will go and, try to kill David, even though he's with Samuel, who God used to, make me king and has been the great spiritual influence over Israel. That doesn't matter. I am going to go and try to kill David. Same thing happens to great King Saul. He's on his way. The Spirit of God falls on him. He is caught up in this ecstatic, experience close to God, prophesying. He's prophesying for 24, like a whole day. And David finds out, and Saul is really close to David at this point. They're in the same city. David doesn't trust Saul. Who knows what Saul is going to do after he comes out of this ecstatic experience. So he flees back to the capital, back to the court, to his friend Jonathan, Prince Jonathan, who is, very close to Saul, obviously, the heir. He wants his dear friend Jonathan to help. He wants to explain the situation. He wants protection and help from Jonathan. Maybe Jonathan can talk his father out of pursuing what he is intent on doing. Chapter 20, verse 1. Then David fled from Naoth in Ramah and came and said to Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my iniquity? What is my sin? What is my sin before your father that he is seeking my life?" In other words, Jonathan, I am innocent, yet your father is trying to kill me. It's not right. It's not fair. You need to know this. We need to do something. Jonathan said to him, "Far from it. You shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. So why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so." Jonathan is skeptical. He doesn't believe that David's report, that King Saul is trying to kill him. He might not have been familiar with the most recent events that's, Saul sent men to capture or kill David while he was at his house, and he had to escape to Samuel. He might not have heard about that. Saul had sworn to Jonathan, made an oath, that he would not harm David. Jonathan still is remembering that, believing that his father would not violate his oath. Yes, his father might have thrown a spear at David to try to pin him to the wall and kill him, but Saul had been doing irrational things. Maybe that was part of his, irrational state when this evil spirit came upon him. It was just a temporary loss of sanity, but his real intent was not to kill David. This is what Jonathan is thinking. And if Saul was intent on killing David, Jonathan was his confidant. Saul would have told his son, and he had not. So Jonathan is skeptical of David's assertion that Saul's trying to kill him. Verse 3, "Yet David bowed again, saying, 'Your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight. And he has said, do not let Jonathan know this, or he will be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and death.'" So David disagrees with his friend Jonathan. Yes, Saul is absolutely intent on killing me. He knows that if he does, it will upset you tremendously, so that's why he hasn't confided in you, but his intent is to kill me. There's no question about it, and there's only like one step between me and death. He's hot on my heels, very close to killing me. Then Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you say, I will do for you." This is one of the great friendships recorded, you know, for us in, I'd say, all of literature, the friendship between David and Jonathan. This commitment they have to each other, this love, this friendship that supersedes position, family loyalty, loyalty to, you know, the father, you know, Jonathan's loyalty to his father, loyalty to his future position as king. Jonathan has this tremendous love for David, and David has this tremendous love for Jonathan, more important than virtually anything else. "Whatever you say, I will do for you, even if it means going against my father." So David said to Jonathan, "Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I ought to sit down to eat with the king." You have to know a little bit about Jewish holidays to understand this. There is a new moon holiday every seventh day. We had a Sabbath the first day of every month, the new moon. There was a special sacrifices, special celebration, not so much celebration, but special sacrifices, according to the Torah, according to the book of Numbers. Over time, it became not just a religious holiday, it became like a civil holiday. The families would get together in the new moon, maybe. Or, in this case, Saul and his court would have a special meal with everyone on the new moon, and not just the first day, but like the next day of the month, the first and second nights. David said to Jonathan, "Behold, tomorrow's the new moon, and I ought to sit down to eat with the king. But let me go, that I may hide myself in the field until the third evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city." And Bethlehem, and where this is taking place, is not that far away from each other. "Let me run to Bethlehem, because it is the yearly sacrifice there for the whole family. If he says it is good, your servant shall be safe, but if he is very angry, know that he has decided on evil." So David comes up with this plan to help flush out where Saul is really at. If it is Saul's intention to kill him, like David thinks, or, you know, to prove to Jonathan where Saul, you know, Saul's intention. So he comes up with this plan. "I'm supposed to be with the king." David is now part of the royal court, right? He's a high-ranking military officer. He is now the king's son-in-law. He's at the highest levels of power in the kingdom. He is expected to participate with all the other high officials and members of the royal family in this two-day celebration of the new moon. If he doesn't show up, Saul, you know, if Saul is not intent on killing him, it's no big deal. But if Saul is intent on killing him, and, you know, him showing up makes it easy for, like, the hunter to catch his prey, and he's disappointed that the prey is not there to be caught and is angry, that will reveal Saul's true intentions. Verse 6 is interesting, one thing. It's the yearly sacrifice for the whole family. It looks like at this point in Jewish history, people were not going to the tabernacle, the Mishkan, to offer sacrifices. According to the Torah, the only place a sacrifice can be offered is at the tabernacle. It seems from this that the tabernacle was not central, kind of had fallen out of favor, and that individual families were offering sacrifices apart from the tabernacle, which is unusual, but I think that's actually what was happening. David.
Did he not tell Jonathan he was going to hide in the field?
Yes. Yes.
This is a personal thing for me to always tell the truth and everything else. In a manner, is he asking Jonathan?
Is David telling the truth here? Or is this part of a deception? Is he telling a lie to fool the king? It could be that he slipped away to Bethlehem, during this time of absence. I mean, it's possible. I don't know exactly how far Gibeah and Bethlehem are. It's not that far. So that is a possibility. Another possibility is David is just lying or encouraging Jonathan to lie. He thinks Saul is his enemy who's about to kill him. So this raises an ethical question. If you are convinced that someone is your enemy and is intent on killing you, are you obligated to tell that person the truth? Normally we tell the truth, right? That's very important. Is it always right to tell the truth in every circumstance? For example, say you're a Christian in World War II in Germany, and the Nazis are murderers. They're systematically killing Jews and gypsies and, they're murderers. Say that you are hiding a Jewish family in your home, and the Gestapo shows up and knocks on your door and says, Mr. Schultz, do you know where any Jews are hiding? If you're Mr. Schultz, are you morally obligated to tell the truth to the Gestapo? The answer is no. You're not morally... That would be a greater sin. That would be a greater sin to tell someone who is intent on murdering an innocent family that you're protecting. You're not obligated to tell the truth in certain situations, like when you're fighting a war. You don't have an obligation to tell your enemy the truth. If you're going to kill them, you can lie to them. Does that make sense? So maybe that's one way we could look at what David is doing. David, your thoughts, your response.
I understand. It's just in a personal journey through life, it's always telling the truth and everything else. And I understand that there are legitimate reasons. I think back to Abraham and his half sister Sarah, and the deception that was there. I'm constantly reminded of that when telling the truth. His intent was to deceive.
Whose?
Abraham, not so much David in this issue. He told the truth.
If you're an undercover police officer, are you obligated to tell the truth to those who you are undercover to, infiltrate? And the answer is no. Can you be a Christian and an undercover police officer? I would say yes. If you're working, you know, as a spy for your government, are you allowed to, you know, pose as someone else and create this whole false identity? I'd say yes. So there are special situations where, under normal circumstances, we don't lie. Lying is very corrosive. It's destructive. God is all truth. He really hates lying. It's a very destructive thing. And so, but under very special circumstances, maybe when you're in war, when you are, you know, there's a Jewish term that covers a lot of these situations. It's called pikuach nefesh. And nefesh is soul, and it's like rescuing a life or saving a life. That is more important than other commandments. Normally, you don't work on the Sabbath. It's a very serious penalty if you work on the Sabbath. If your animal falls into a pit, you don't leave the poor animal in the pit. waiting for the Sabbath to end, you work getting the animal out because the life of the animal is more important than you observing the Sabbath in that case. Pikuach nefesh, like, you know, saving a life. So, that's okay. You know, David is trying to save his own life. There really is like one step between him and death. He needs the help of his friend Jonathan. Is it right to create this scenario that will reveal where Saul's true intentions? Anyway, he does it. You be the judge if you feel comfortable with him doing that. Verse 8, David continues to talk to his friend Jonathan. Therefore, deal kindly with your servant. Tell your father this story. We'll find out where he's at. Then deal kindly with your servant, referring to himself. For you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. But if there is iniquity in me, put me to death yourself. For why then should you bring me to your father? So David is anticipating the response. Let's say that Saul indeed is angry and is intent on killing David. And this is revealed to Jonathan. And Saul says to Jonathan, Jonathan, David's life is over. I am going to kill him. And if you interfere, if you warn him, you know, I might kill you. Your life or David's life. David is anticipating, you know, that if that happens, Jonathan might be tempted to, you know, give David up. So he says, "Deal kindly with me. We've made a covenant. Remember that we're, you know, a covenant of friendship." Don't betray me. Be loyal to me. Even though this is your father, the king, who could do, you know, something very unpleasant. If I'm, you know, that's if I'm innocent. If I'm guilty, don't even bother your father. Kill me yourself. Jonathan's response, verse 9. Jonathan said, "Far be it from you." That you've done something, bad. For if I should indeed learn that evil has been decided by my father to come upon you, then would I not tell you about it? It's reassuring, David. David, don't worry. If it turns out that my father's intention is to kill you, I will let you know. I will not be deterred. I will not be dissuaded, no matter what the consequences are. Jonathan is a true, loyal friend. Then David said to Jonathan, David's smart. He's a really smart guy. He really thinks ahead. He plans ahead. He's like a chess master. He's thinking out all the possible scenarios and how to handle each scenario. David said to Jonathan, "Who will tell me if your father answers you harshly? If it becomes clear that Saul's intent is to kill David, Jonathan, how are you going to communicate that to me?" Saul has spies. Jonathan is the royal, you know, is the prince. Saul is intent on killing David. Jonathan is his friend. Everyone knows this. Jonathan is going to be under constant, surveillance. Surveillance, right? Saul knows that Jonathan's likely to try to warn David. Who will tell me if your father answers you harshly? How are you going to communicate what you find out to me if the answer is his intention is to kill me? Jonathan said to David, "Come and let us go into the field." So both of them went out to the field. Then Jonathan said to David, "The Lord, the God of Israel, be witness. When I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or the third day, behold, if there is good or good feeling toward David, shall I not then send to you and make it known to you? If it please my father to do you harm, may the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also, if I do not make it known to you and send you away, that you may go in safety." This is, a vow. "May the Lord punish me if I do not warn you, if my father is intent on killing you. And may the Lord be with you as he has been with my father." Something dramatic is happening here. Jonathan is a very spiritual man. He is close to God, like David. And he senses, he knows that David is going to be the future king of Israel, not Jonathan. And Jonathan is good with that. And if David has to flee, if he has to go into exile, because there's no place safe left in Israel, Jonathan believes that the Lord will protect David, the Lord will give David victory, the Lord will bring David back, the Lord will make David king over Israel. "May the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. If I'm still alive, will you not show me the love of the Lord that I may not die? You shall not cut off your love from my house forever, not even when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." David, I believe that you're going to be the future king of Israel. You're going to be victorious when that happens. Remember our relationship. Remember our covenant. Spare me, spare my family. It's like roles have already started being reversed. Jonathan is the prince. He's the heir to the throne. Jonathan senses that that's not going to last. David will be the king. Now he is coming to David for help and protection. Roles are starting to reverse already between these two great men. Verse 16, "So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, 'May the Lord require it at the hands of David's enemies. May the Lord, punish all of David's enemies, even if it includes my father.'" I think that's what he's saying. Jonathan made David vow again. They had already made a covenant. They're renewing the covenant of friendship, even at this crucial time, because of his love for him, because he loved him as he loved his own life. Again, this is one of the great friendships in all of literature, certainly in the Bible, between these two men. The depth of love and the respect that they had for each other, where they were willing to choose each other above everyone else. Especially hard for Jonathan, but he did. Then Jonathan said to him, "Tomorrow is the new moon, and you will be missed because your seat will be empty. When you have stayed for 3 days," so it looks like he did stay, he didn't go to Bethlehem, "you shall go down quickly and come to the place where you hid yourself on that eventful day, and you shall remain by the stone Ezel." "I will shoot 3 arrows to the side as though I shot at a target, and behold, I will send the lad saying, 'Go find the arrows.' If I specifically say to the lad, 'Behold, the arrows are on this side of you,' then get them, then come, for there is safety for you and no harm, as the Lord lives. But if I say to the youth, 'Behold, the arrows are beyond you,' go, for the Lord has sent you away." So this is the way they're going to communicate. This is the predetermined plan. If he shoots 3 arrows to the side of the stone, you're okay. If he shoots 3 arrows and he says to the lad, they're further, you have to go further. That's a secret message to David that you have to go further. You have to flee. Saul is going to kill you. "As for the agreement of which you and I have spoken, behold, the Lord is between you and me forever." I love how much they talk about the Lord. As I was reading this chapter this week and thinking about it, these two men talk about the Lord a lot. I don't know how many times in this chapter, but they're constantly thinking about the Lord, talking about the Lord, acknowledging the Lord, his activity, his faithfulness. I think we could learn from Jonathan and David. I think most Christians, most Messianic Jews, we just don't talk about the Lord enough. We talk about other things, but not so much the Lord. And we're kind of afraid to talk about the Lord, God, in our daily conversation. Anyway, it struck me that these two men were constantly thinking about the Lord, talking about the Lord, acknowledging the Lord, seeing the Lord, giving credit to the Lord. "So David hid in the field, and when the new moon came, the king sat down to eat food. The king sat on his seat as usual, the seat by the wall. Then Jonathan rose up, and Abner, who is the head of the army, sat down by Saul's side." He's also a relative of Saul. "But David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul did not speak anything that day," regarding David is the implication, "for he thought, 'It's an accident. He's not clean. Surely he is not clean.'" For a Jewish person living according to the Sinai covenant, ritual cleanliness was important to go to the temple, to the Mishkan, the tabernacle, to worship, to offer sacrifices. It seems that ritual cleanliness was also a factor in, a special celebration like this. So Saul is thinking David has become ritually unclean. He's, touched a dead body. He is come in contact with something that will make him unclean. That's why he has not decided to show up at this important meal of the royal court. Remember, David is now a high military officer and the king's son-in-law and was expected to be there. Uh, It came about the next day, the second day of the new moon, that David's place was empty. So Saul said to Jonathan, his son, "Why has the son of Jesse not come to the meal, either yesterday or today?" Jonathan then answered Saul, "David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. For he said, 'Please let me go, since our family has a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to attend.'" The older brother who's the head of the family. "And now, if I have found favor in your sight, please let me get away that I may see my brothers. For this reason, he has not come to the king's table." So Jonathan rehearses or gives the story to the king. "Then Saul's anger burned against Jonathan. And he said to him, 'You son of a perverse, rebellious woman.'" Obviously, he's insulting. He's angry. He is insulting his son. When you insult someone's mother, you know, that's an insult, right? People tend to love their mothers. When you call someone, what did you say? "You son of a perverse, rebellious woman." The implication is he shares the same nature as his mother. He is perverse. He is rebellious. In other words, "You perverse, rebellious child. Do I not know that you are choosing the son of David to your own shame and the shame of your mother's nakedness?" excuse me. Jonathan, you're an embarrassment. My son, you are an embarrassment. You're an embarrassment to yourself. You're an embarrassment to your mother. You're a perverse, rebellious man. You're choosing David over yourself. You're choosing David over me. You're choosing David over your future. Verse 31, "For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established." He's your threat. He's your competition. How can you choose David over yourself? Son, you're a complete embarrassment. You're ashamed to your family, to your mother, to yourself, to me. "Therefore now send and bring him to me, for he must surely die." So Saul has revealed his intentions. David was right all along. Jonathan had misunderstood the depth, the intention of his father's hatred towards David, his intention to kill him. It's crystal clear. Saul commands his son to bring David to him for execution. Jonathan responds, verse 32, "But Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said to him, 'Why should he be put to death? What has he done?'" He's innocent. Give me his crimes. Give me his sins. If he's, done something worthy of death, fine. If he's innocent, you can't just kill someone. "Then Saul hurled his spear at Jonathan to strike him down." King Saul is so infuriated. And remember, he's struggling with madness at this point, with, he's got an evil spirit from the Lord, mental instability, he's not, anger, hatred, insecurity, jealousy, raging within him. He throws his spear at Jonathan to kill Jonathan in a fit of rage. So Jonathan knew that his father had decided to put David to death. Then Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger, angry with his father, what he just insulted him in front of the whole royal court, angry with his father for trying to kill him, angry with his father for the way he's treating David. He did not eat food on the second day of the new moon. He was grieved over David because his father had dishonored him. Dishonored David, dishonored Jonathan. Now it came about in the morning that Jonathan went out into the field for the appointment with David, and a little lad was with him, and he said to his lad, "Run, find now the arrows which I am about to shoot." As the lad was running, he shot an arrow past him. When the lad reached the place of the arrow which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan called after the lad and said, "Is not the arrow beyond you?" Those are the key words. He shot the arrow beyond him. The arrow's beyond you. Secret code to David. You need to flee. Jonathan called after the lad, "Hurry, be quick, do not stay." Jonathan's lad picked up the arrow and came to his master. The lad was not aware of anything. Only Jonathan and David knew about the matter. So this was their secret code. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to his lad and said to him, "Go bring them to the city." When the lad was gone, David rose from the south side and fell on his face to the ground. Great respect for his dear friend Jonathan, who has risked so much for him. And he bowed down not once, not twice, three times. Tremendous respect and honor for Prince Jonathan. And they kissed each other and they wept together, but David wept more. It's going to be difficult for Jonathan living with his, you know, father who's angry. It's going to be more difficult for David. He has to go into exile. He might never see his friend Jonathan again. Jonathan said to David, "Go in safety, go in peace, inasmuch as we have sworn to each other in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord will be between me and you and between my descendants and your descendants forever.' We have this covenant. I want you to be safe. I'm keeping my covenant. No matter what it costs me, no matter what my father does to me, we have this agreement. I love you. You're my dear friend. The Lord, you know, we made a covenant between the Lord. Go in peace." He rose and departed while Jonathan went into the city. This is the beginning of David's exile, fleeing from place to place, with Saul still trying to hunt him down and kill him. David is going to be shaped and formed by this whole experience with Saul, Saul's many attempts to kill him, Saul, this great, powerful king. The Lord will help David stay that step ahead of death. The Lord will show himself strong on David. A number of the Psalms reflect what the incidents of this period where the Lord is protecting David according to, you know, the Lord's promises to David. Questions? What else do we want to talk about? Church shooting? Yeah, you can continue taping, sure. Thank you, Donna. What about that church shooting in Texas? I mean, it's like unbelievably. What about that church shooting in Texas? Well, a lot of things go through my mind. There are monsters among us. This guy was a monster. Um, hardcore atheist, no fear of God. When there's no fear of God, if there's no heaven, no hell, no day of judgment, why not do something like this? If it, you know, if it entertains you, no God, no judgment, no heaven, no hell, why not? Fear of God, fear of hell, to me is a huge restrainer on human evil. Our society has rejected God. Western civilization has turned away from God a long time ago. There's no fear of God, no belief in heaven, no belief in hell. A lot of violence in our movies and pop culture and video games, constant diet, atheism and violence. The human soul is already dark, prone to, you know, dark things. I think that's a large part of, you know, the senseless violence, mass shootings that we see all the time, like a daily, almost like a daily occurrence now. Every church should have a security detail. Every synagogue should have a security detail. Every mosque should have a security detail. Shema's got a security detail. Every synagogue in like Metro Detroit has, you know, security. The Jewish community's been targeted, you know, for years now. So virtually every synagogue has off-duty police officers. Churches should too. We have a number of people who are ex-military, ex-law enforcement, present law enforcement, and so we have a security detail that keeps an eye on things. They train themselves and look out for things like this. If something like this happened on a Shabbat, probably some people would get killed, because, you know, but the guy would not have, you know, free rein. Anyway, very depressing. He shot, you know, infants, children. This guy was truly a monster. We can expect more of it. I don't think the right response is to eliminate, you know, guns from American society. I think that would be virtually impossible at this point. I think better armed citizens would help. There's not enough time to call the police. They can't do anything, right? So, anyway. You have any thoughts or comments?
Well, you know, Rabbi Martin, the elite, they have their security, but they try to disarm us.
The elite have their security, their bodyguards who are armed, but they don't want us to have the right to do it ourselves. That's true. It's, to me, that's very hypocritical. You know, if you have a trained bodyguard, a trained killer, you know, killer, that you could afford, most person, people can't afford, you know, to have their own bodyguard, right? I mean, that's crazy. To me, that's part of the reason for the Second Amendment. So, it is hypocritical to have your own trained bodyguards and not allow that same right to individuals who can't afford that. Anything else? Joe.
Sacrifices for sin before the Day of Atonement throughout the year?
were there sacrifices for sin throughout the year other than the Day of Atonement? The answer is yes, sure. If an individual sinned, you know, he bring a sin offering, sure. What would be the reason for the Day of Atonement? It was national atonement for the entire nation. Individual sin offerings for individuals who sinned. Yom Kippur was for the nation. Even though we're the chosen people, we sinned. We fell short. The chosen people needed national atonement once a year. Even the temple, where atonement took place, it needed to be cleansed once a year on Yom Kippur. The altar needed to be cleansed. The most holy place needed blood. You know, the Ark of the Covenant needed to, because sin is pervasive. And so even the holy people of Israel, even the high priest who offered the sacrifices on behalf of the nation, he first offered a sin, you know, a bull for his own sins and the sins of his family. So yes, sin is pervasive, and the Torah acknowledges that, you know, with the guilt offerings, the sin offerings for individuals and for the entire nation on Yom Kippur.
During the captivity and after the return before Jesus?
How was sin atoned for during the captivity period when there was no temple, and then the time prior to the arrival of Jesus? There were no sacrifices after the temple was destroyed in 586 BC. The temple was not rebuilt for another 70 years. So there were no sacrifices that were offered during that time. No atonement going on, no national atonement going on. The temple was rebuilt, and the sacrifices were reinstituted, and they remained in place until 70 AD when the temple was destroyed again. But really, I think the demarcation point is the coming of Yeshua, who died around 30 AD, 33 AD. And after he dies, you know, the sacrifices at the temple really don't cut it. His death, you know, inaugurates the new covenant, and the Jewish people could not ignore the sacrifice of Yeshua, and after his sacrifice, offer a bull, a goat, a ram, a lamb, a pigeon, and think that they were getting real atonement. God finalized that in 70 AD when the temple was destroyed, and there is left no doubt that there's no atonement. And it's interesting, there was like a 40-year transition period, roughly 30 AD till 70 AD. From the death of Yeshua till the temple was destroyed. The number 40 is significant. It's a time of judgment and testing in the Bible. God gave Israel like 40 years of transition while the apostles are taking over and doing great things and preaching the good news about Yeshua and doing miracles. God graciously gave Israel like 40 years to repent, until the temple was destroyed, and really Israel was destroyed in 70 AD. Go for it.
So, during the captivity, during the captivity and until the temple was rebuilt and the sacrificial system started again, before Jesus, there's that gap.
That 70-year gap.
So
what happened to people during those 70 years? I don't know. I don't know. Some of them were alive when the temple was destroyed and the sacrifices were going. Some of them were alive when the temple was rebuilt and the sacrifices were reinstituted. Maybe that was enough to give those who needed atonement the atonement they needed. The righteous do live by faith. They needed to have faith. You know, God, yeah, God is merciful. But I am sure that today, without the temple and the priests offering sacrifices at the temple, my Jewish people who think that, you know, they're in good spiritual shape, but they are not bringing their, you know, sacrifice, they're not in good, they're not in good shape. Anything else? Howard.
The issue of David not quite telling the truth reminded of the story, I think it's in Exodus, the two Hebrew midwives.
Mm-hmm. Howard reminds us of the issue of David not telling the truth, or encouraging Jonathan to deceive his father, not tell the truth. And Howard reminds us of the story recorded in the Torah in Exodus, the two Jewish midwives who were told to kill all the baby boys and refused to follow Pharaoh's decree and lied to Pharaoh. And they are commended by God and honored by God and rewarded, right? They did the right thing. And this is my point, you know, before with pikuach nefesh, you know, saving a life, that when someone is abusing their authority, and it's a life and death situation, you are not morally obligated to cooperate with them by telling them the truth. And that's a great example, Howard, thank you, from Exodus, the two Jewish midwives who flat out lied to Pharaoh in order to save these Jewish babies. These Jewish women, they are tough, they're out in the field, they're in great shape, they deliver so fast, we just don't have time to get there and help them deliver their children, that's why we couldn't do it. It was a lie. Plausible lie. Plausible deniability. But they're commended for that lie, because you don't have to cooperate with, a murderer. Right? That's naive.
So, how about this scenario? I'm going to take your life. Are you a Christian? Yes or no?
How about this scenario? A man points a gun at you and says, I am going to, are you a Christian? If you're a Christian, I'm going to shoot you. If not, if you deny that you're a Christian, I won't. Most Christians, and that's a different kind of scenario. In that situation, you got to say, yes, I'm a Christian. I'm a follower of Jesus. You don't deny him. Many, many Christians, many Messianic Jews have faced that situation. And the faith has pretty much universally commended those who made the tough call and condemned those who lied in that situation.
I already knew the answer, but I wanted to hear you say it.
Yeah. Think there's going to be a war between Saudi Arabia and Iran?
I
You don't think it'll be contained. Saudi Arabia and Iran are like deadly enemies, right? They're two of the major powers in the Middle East, Shia, Islam, Iran, Sunni Islam, you know, Saudi Arabia, where, you know, Mecca is. And so there's been tension between Shia and Sunni for, you know, a thousand years more, right? There's been this proxy war in Yemen, south of Saudi Arabia, between the Houthi rebels, which are part of, you know, funded by Iran, and the rest of Yemen, which is, you know, Sunni. Hezbollah in Lebanon has become very powerful. Hezbollah is Shia, supported by Iran, you know, hates Israel, wants to destroy Israel. They're very close to going to war.
Well, it's interesting, too. Saudi Arabia is not mentioned as part of the alliance of Ezekiel 38 coming against Israel.
Saudi Arabia is not mentioned in Ezekiel 38 as part of that alliance going against Israel. That's true. Therefore, what, Bill?
I think it's interesting that right now they seem to be partnering up with Saudi Arabia, even though they have different ideologies.
Who's partnering up with Saudi Arabia?
Israel.
Israel and Saudi Arabia do seem to be partnering up. Israel is much more concerned about the threat of Iran.
Well, nevertheless, though, I think it's interesting that they're not mentioned as part of that contingency. Turkey, Libya, Persia.
Yep. So Saudi Arabia might not be in the picture.
Or that, or they're not
enemy. Not a bitter enemy. Interesting. Anything else? The wild weather? What about the wild weather, the hurricanes? Could be a record cold tonight. One thing I found out over my lifetime about the weather, Millie, it changes. the weather changes a lot. I mean, you know, for like 10 or 13 years, there were no hurricanes that hit the United States. And then in one season, we got like three really big, you know, hurricanes that hit the U.S. To me, that's more illustrative of how this world works. It's not always just nice and normal and smooth. There are times when things can run smoothly for a long time and suddenly, you know, something dramatic happens. And I think that is very true of the way God's designed nature, and sudden unexpected you know, events can like come out of nowhere. Weird things happen. That's what life is like in a fallen world. Life can be running smoothly for a long time and suddenly just like out of nowhere, you know, bam. So, I don't know. I am skeptical of, you know, climate change. The climate's always changing. Climate change is just, to me, another word for weather. The weather's always changing. Maybe, you know. Anything else? Okay, we have some books in back that you're welcome to take. Other stuff. David Sr., do you mind ending our time with a prayer?